On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Under my administration, Wall Street CEOs will no longer receive a get-out-of-jail-free card. Not only will big banks not be too big to fail, but big-time bankers will not be too big to jail.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders earlier this year, he has promised to break up the country's biggest financial institutions in his first year in office. It's one of the central tenets of his campaign. And he was asked about how he would do that in an interview with the editorial board of the New York Daily News. Well, now he's being criticized for seeming vague and evasive in that interview. But is the criticism fair? As the California primary nears, we will periodically examine the promises candidates are making. And today, how would Sanders break up the big banks? Dean Baker is an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. That's a think tank in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin by hearing a little of the exchange that's getting Sanders into a little bit of trouble today. It starts with a question from the Daily News editorial board.
How? I mean, how does a president turn to J.P. Morgan Chase or have the Treasury turn to any of those banks and say, now you must do X, Y, and Z?
Well, you do have authority under the Dodd-Frank legislation to do that.
Okay. So, Dean Baker, does the president have the authority under Dodd-Frank to do that?
Well, he doesn't directly. I mean, the body that has the authority is the Financial Stability Oversight Council, and that's a body of 10 people composed of the heads of most of the major regulatory agencies, including the Treasury Secretary. There's 9 others. In addition, the head of the Board of Governors is there, the Comptroller of the Currency, the Director of the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, the SEC, FDIC, I won't go the whole list. Mm-hmm. These are, in most cases, I'd have to double check, but in most cases, these are presidential appointees. Not immediately, though. So, you know, if Bernie Sanders gets elected and, you know, he goes, I want to break up the big banks, he may be able to persuade, you know, the ones that he's not appointed yet that they should go along. He'll appoint, of course, the Treasury Secretary. He appoints the chair of the Fed the next year after he takes office. So over time, he would eventually have a majority of this body. But the day he walks into office, he would not. But that doesn't mean he wouldn't be able to persuade, you know, the other members so that he would have a majority.
So if this body said, okay, J.P. Morgan Chase, you need to break up, they could force them to do that? And then what would happen?
Well, basically, you know, again, they could do different routes, but most likely what they would do is impose penalties for being too large. And the most obvious one is you simply tax, you know, impose a tax. Let's say, you know, I'm picking a number out of the air. Let's say they decide $500 billion is the biggest size a bank should be. You shouldn't have assets more than $500 billion. J.P. Morgan's around $2 trillion today. So they tell J.P. Morgan, okay, we want you to get under $500 billion. We're going to impose a tax of, let's say, 1% on all of your assets in excess of $500 billion. Now, they probably wouldn't do that tomorrow, but just for, you know, purpose of discussion, let's say they say, okay, as of, you know, next month, you know. So, you know, that's going to be an onerous burden to J.P. Morgan. So J.P. Morgan would likely go, okay, we don't want to pay that fine. We will look to break ourselves up as quickly as possible.
So, in effect, breaking themselves up into a savings institution and an investing institution, things like that.
Well, that would be their call. And, you know, again, people were making fun of Sanders because he didn't have a specific plan. And, you know, I think Senator Sanders said exactly the right route that, you know, you tell them, we want you below X size. And J.P. Morgan knows how to do that in the most efficient way. So we don't need and we don't want the regulators to say, okay, here's how you break yourself up. We want, you know, this is what we consider too big. You figure out how to get under that ceiling.
So I think a lot of people thought that Dodd-Frank would take care of this, but now that the dust has settled and people are really examining what Dodd-Frank can and cannot do, I think there is some disappointment, at least on people from people who think that the banks are too big, that it has the kind of power that some people had intended. Even Neil Kashkari, who is head of the Fed in Minneapolis, says that Dodd-Frank doesn't go far enough.
Yeah, well, certainly Dodd-Frank doesn't require regulators to act. So, you know, you could envision if you had different regulators there that they would behave differently given the powers in Dodd-Frank. So Dodd-Frank definitely gives this regulatory body, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, the authority to break up large banks, but it doesn't require them. So, you know, if someone hoped that, you know, we passed Dodd-Frank, now we're going to break up the large banks, well, clearly not with the regulators we have in there today.
Sanders is also in favor of bringing back Glass-Steagall, which was a Depression-era law repealed back in 1999, and many people blame that repealing as one of the reasons for the financial crisis. Was that part of what he was talking about in the interview, and is it realistic? Is there a move in Congress to do that, bring back some version of Glass-Steagall?
Well, there certainly is a move in Congress, and it's to some extent bipartisan. Senator Warren's sponsored a bill to that effect, along with Senator Vitter, from a Republican from Louisiana, and I believe Senator McCain also has been a supporter of that. So you do have some Republican support for that. So I don't envision that passing tomorrow. I mean, clearly they don't have a majority, and, you know, frankly, I have no idea whether, you know, if they were to pass it, whether President Obama would sign it or not. But in any case, it's not something that will happen tomorrow. But there is certainly support, political support for that. Is it feasible economically? I don't see a big problem with it. I mean, I'm not one of the people who sees the repeal of Glass-Steagall as a main factor, or even not sure any factor contributing to the housing bubble and the financial crisis. But I do think there's a simplicity about keeping depository institutions that take government guaranteed deposits separate from institutions that engage in more risky activity. The Volcker Rule, which is part of Dodd-Frank, was designed in part to do that, and it has been more effective than I expected. You have a number of banks that have offloaded their trading divisions, and that's what you want to see. But the problem that I think we see with any regulation is that it tends to get weaker over time. There's always a lot of pressure coming from the industry to weaken regulation, and that, to my mind, is an argument for having very clear lines, and I don't think the lines are very clear with the Volcker Rule. With Glass-Steagall, they're pretty clear.
So, as I said earlier, this is one of the central tenets of Sanders' campaign and his candidacy, and that is blaming Wall Street for the financial mess and to break up the banks. When it comes to that idea, breaking up the banks, where do you rank that in terms of importance in the health of the economy?
Well, I don't think it's a huge factor, at least in the near-term health, but I think it does. I guess I'd put two things here. One is that as long as you have banks that are too big to fail, you do have the risk that they will basically the idea is that they're going to take on risk that they're passing to the government because, you know, at the end of the day, everyone knows the government's going to bail them out. So you don't want that. The other is that it's not you're basically, by virtue of the fact, if I'm J.P. Morgan and everyone thinks I'm too big to fail, we're in effect subsidizing the top, you know, the top executives, the shareholders of J.P. Morgan, because they're in effect being given free insurance from the government. And I can't see any reason on earth that we would want to be subsidizing some of the richest people in the country. We have a lot of uses for public money. That's not a good one.
Right. But also the idea that if we have a bunch of banks that are too big to fail, we could be on the hook for another massive government bailout if there's another financial crisis around the corner.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the one issue. But again, I think the more important point is the crisis rather than being on the hook. So in other words, you know, let's envision we'd gotten the downturn in 2008 and we weren't on the hook for, you know, we could just tell them all, you know, okay, we don't care, go under. We still had a really bad downturn. That would, to my mind, is the worst part of the story, not that, you know, we had to bail them out.
Well, Sanders indeed links the two. I mean, he says the reason for the downturn was these big banks making faulty loans and basically committing fraud against the American public.
Well, clearly the bad loans, you know, you had banks inflating the housing bubble. Now, they weren't all too big to fail. Some of them did fail. But, you know, the fact that you had banks that were acting in a very irresponsible way, making and packaging loans that they had every reason in the world to know were bad, that was what got us into the crisis. So,
and breaking up the banks wouldn't preclude that necessarily.
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it's a good thing to do, but you could envision, you know, you go back to the 80s and the S&L crisis, those banks were too big to fail. I mean, the biggest of them had assets of, you know, maybe $5 billion, you know, put in today's economy, maybe it'd be $20 or $30 billion. That's chump change, you know. So none of those were too big to fail, but they managed to have a pretty serious run of, you know, bad loans. So I don't think it's necessarily a story of too big to fail being a necessary condition for the sort of bubble bad practices that we saw during the housing bubble years.
Dean Baker is an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
All right, we'd love to hear from you. Do you believe what the candidates promise? Do you take them with a huge grain of salt? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, part of the reason that banks got so big in the first place are the legal rights granted them by the federal government. Rights that you might think were only granted to people, like free speech. There was a lot of attention paid to the idea of corporate personhood after the Citizens United case back in 2010. But the idea that corporations are people goes further back than that. According to Mike Schlitt, it goes all the way back, believe it or not, to the constitutional amendment that granted rights to former slaves, the 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868. Mike Schlitt is a regular commentator on Press Play. He's an amateur historian and a lifelong political junkie. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Madeline. I like that according to Mike Schlitt. I like that.
I know. According to no one but you. That's not true. Other people have written about this. The 14th Amendment was adopted as part of Reconstruction just after the Civil War, and basically one of its powers was to grant citizenship rights to former slaves, equal protection. So let's just talk about how they were regarded legally until then.
Slaves are considered to be property, not people, and in fact, it was this great compromise about what to do about that problem. So that's been sort of brewing and avoided and swept under the rug from 1787 until the nation finally implodes in a civil war, and it can't be avoided anymore.
So the 14th Amendment grants former slaves five-fifths status. They are full human beings. It did a lot of other things as well. And before we get to this idea of corporations using it to define themselves as people, it also started a battle over states' rights. So tell us about that.
There are a lot of people that are concerned about too much federal government power, especially after the Civil War. And so when the 14th Amendment makes its way through the court system, justices sort of reverse the idea. And instead of protecting former slaves not to be discriminated against, what they do is protect the rights of individuals living in states to discriminate against those former slaves.
So at the same time that the rights of these new black citizens in the South are being whittled away, there are rights being granted to a kind of artificial citizen, a corporate citizen.
Yes, correct. The 14th Amendment was the first introduction of the notion of corporate personhood. And how that happened is, at the time, the railroads are basically the engine of the Industrial Revolution, and the railroads have their advocates in the court system throughout state and federal courts trying to protect against regulation, government regulation, trying to limit their taxes. And so they get the great idea to use these privileges and immunities of persons provided in the 14th Amendment to be applied towards corporations. And there are two cases that really bring this forward. Roscoe Conkling, who's a former senator, who's one of the guys that wrote the 14th Amendment, is arguing in front of the Supreme Court, and he makes this, most likely is perjuring himself in front of the Supreme Court, holds up the Congressional Journal and says, yes, when we wrote Big 14, we specifically decided not to distinguish between natural and artificial citizens because we wanted corporations to have all the rights and privileges that this amendment guaranteed.
Did he actually say Big 14 and artificial persons?
He did say artificial persons. Big 14 is just a term that I like to use.
Yes.
and that other historians, amateur and otherwise, like to use.
Okay. So how did they start using it? What did they want to be conferred upon them, these railroads?
The railroads wanted to have corporate personhood because rights of personhood guaranteed in the 14th Amendment give you First Amendment rights, which is what we're dealing with right now in Citizens United. It gives Fourth Amendment rights, which protects against illegal search and seizure, which means that a company, corporation, doesn't have to open up their books if they don't want to. It protects a corporation against Fifth Amendment rights of self-incrimination. So, you know, basically corporations live to create profits. So what you have is you have these limited liability corporations using the notion of corporate personhood and using these amendment rights to protect their ability to generate profit and without any personal liability.
Okay, so the 14th Amendment doesn't spell out what a person is. There is a conspiracy theory that that was intentional, that it wasn't as much about the rights of former slaves, but to create a kind of corporate personhood.
You know, I don't buy into the notion of a you know, quote unquote, cabal of conspirators putting this together. But I mean, you know, it's just simply what people in power and people trying to make money do. And case in point, as far as what the 14th Amendment was intended to do versus what it ended up doing, in the first 50 years after its ratification, you end up with less than 0.5% of all the Supreme Court cases on the 14th Amendment involve protection of African Americans, and more than half of them involve protection of corporations.
The 14th Amendment has been used in lots of cases, including Roe v. Wade. I mean, there are lots of ways that 14th Amendment has been used to extend due process to all sorts of people. But there is an irony here, Mike, that the 14th Amendment was designed to protect the rights of individuals and ended up protecting the rights of corporations.
Look, the Constitution begins with the words, we the people, okay? And yet we continue in our history to perpetuate fictions about what people are. We created the institution of slavery, which is a legal fiction that people are property. We tried to fix that problem, and we end up today with another legal fiction, corporate personhood, that property are people. So, you know, we continue to subvert this notion of we the people.
Thank you. I consider you a full person. So thank you for being.
And I consider you the same.
And thank you for speaking to the corporation of KCRW. You can hear more of Mike Schlitt on his podcast. It's called The Early Bird Special. And you can follow his adventures on the presidential campaign at MikeSchlitt.com. Coming up on the program, the military has begun opening up combat roles to women. Are they up to it? That's next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, look out, G.I. Joe, because here comes G.I. Jane.
Today, I'm announcing my decision not to make continued exceptions. That is, to proceed with opening all these remaining occupations and positions to women.
That's Defense Secretary Ashton Carter announcing back in December that women are now allowed to serve in combat positions. Before that announcement, about 10% or 220,000 military positions were closed to women. Well, this month, women are being integrated into combat positions. And to tell us what that means, I spoke with Gail Semek-Lamon. She's senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. And I began by asking her what has happened so far.
Well, right now, you see a lot of plans being made for the future. Right. And so this has been a whole march of history that started, you know, way back in the 1940s and is going to proceed it until today, where roles that had been closed to women are slowly opening up. And now what you see is there are no roles now that are going to be left that are closed to women. But the standards is really the central question for every woman in uniform you talk to, that no one wants the standards changed. They simply want an opportunity to meet them. But the question now is, how many months will it take and how will integration actually proceed? But already you see the Marines have their first female candidate for Marine Special Operations Assessment and Selection. There are women who have put in their packets already, as they say in the military, for Navy SEAL BUDS selection. And so you do slowly see roles that were closed to women now opening up. And I think this is a march of history that has been going on for a long time. But really, the post 9/11 wars changed everything.
How many women actually want these front-of-the-line combat positions?
You know, it's hard to tell, but there's definitely not an insignificant number, right? The armed services is now about 15% female, right? More than 300,000 women, the numbers are inexact, have deployed in the post-9/11 wars. More than 150 women have been killed in action in Iraq and Afghanistan just since 9/11. So if you want to talk about what's really been happening, women have been on the front line for years. And in fact, General Rainey, who leads Fort Stewart in Georgia, was just talking about this. He said, you know, everybody's having these abstract discussions about women in combat. But the truth is that women have been there and regulations are just catching up. And in fact, Ashley's War is the story of an all-women special operations team recruited for Army Ranger and Navy SEAL combat operations back in 2011, while the combat was very much in place, but they were needed, and so they were recruited.
Now, this is the subject of your book. That's the name of your book, Ashley's War. And you are talking about a group of women who were sent to the front lines in Afghanistan because they needed to talk to Afghan women.
That's right. I mean, this was a team of soldiers who were recruited from across the Army, Guard, and Reserve. And they had to go through an assessment and selection process called 100 Hours of Hell to be chosen. And in the same camp where the Green Berets are selected, Camp McCall in North Carolina. And they were chosen because they were fit and they were fierce and they were intense and they were female. And the reason why they were needed because they were female was because, as Admiral Olson, was the first Navy SEAL to lead Special Operations Command, said, we need women out there on this Special Operations battlefield because we're never going to kill our way to the end of this war. And all this information that women hold in this conservative traditional area is going unknown and unseen because male American soldiers cannot speak to Afghan women without causing grave offense because of cultural traditions.
So why did the women need to be fit if this was basically conversation?
But it was not conversation. It was combat.
It was
combat in the heart of, you know, I don't know if you've seen Zero Dark Thirty,
right,
for your listeners.
Right.
It's that kind of combat operation experienced by less than 5% of the United States military. And so it does not matter what your job is. You need to be able to put 50 pounds of weight on your back in the dark of night, get on a helicopter, land that helicopter, go as many, sometimes 5 kilometers, sometimes 10, sometimes up very steep hills, sometimes down. When you're one of 50 people in a Ranger platoon or one of, you know, 10 people on a SEAL team mission, no one cares what your role is when you're going in. You're in combat. So you better be fit enough to keep up. And for the teammates of Ashley's War, and this, you know, sometimes they would joke about this, there was always this fear that you would be the one who was the person who slowed everybody down, because that was always the stereotype about women. So you had, you know, the women in Ashley's War were doing CrossFit 3 times a day. They were already, you know, pretty fit, but then they sort of ratcheted it up. And Ashley White was, well, used to, the Rangers would joke in the gym that she was a beast who would put them to shame because she would bust out, you know, 20, 25 pull-ups from a dead hang.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, you talk about body armor in this book and how the women had to adjust. They had to wear Spanx to get the body armor to fit properly.
The first war story probably was Spanx in it. But yeah, that, you know, that was this kind of a sign of the fact that the uniforms were made for men.
Right. And so now, will the Army Marine Corps, will they now readjust their body armor?
It is such an excellent question. I mean, you know, Ashley's War was a story about these pioneers who were really first in all kinds of ways. Women have been doing that job since 2001, though, in ones and twos. Convoy leaders, truck drivers, you know, sometimes mechanics. Hey, do you want to go get bad guys? Hey, we need a girl. Will you help us come on mission? With almost no training or preparation because the war demanded it. So they were kind of the end of the kind of pioneering process. And now we see officially these roles open up. And what you hear a lot of advocates for women the military say is, okay, part of the injury issue that people always talk about around women in the military is the gear doesn't fit and it's not made mm-hmm. for female bodies. And in fact, within the Army, they've been asking, so what do we need for readiness? And a lot of the times women would joke, you know, we don't need hygiene training. You know, we can handle our own biology, our own female issues, because that is something that comes up a lot in the conversation.
You mean getting their period?
Exactly. Thank you. Yes. That is what I mean. But what we need is gear that fits. You know, in Ashley's where the joke was everything was too tight where it should be loose and too loose where it should be tight.
What about the living situations when they're out on patrol? They can be out on patrol for, what, 30 days at a time in some cases, maybe more. So these are close living conditions, harsh living conditions, men and women together. What are some of the conflicts that arise?
There are a lot of concerns, and they came up in a RAND study, Special Operations. But the one truth that America hasn't really known is that women have been in Delta for years. Women have been out on all kinds of special operations missions for years, and they are professionals. And it is about leadership and professionalism.
But are the guys professionals?
Absolutely. I mean, they would tell you, honestly and truly.
Because there has been concern about sexual assault.
For sure. And I think, you know, it's interesting because when the combat ban was lifted in 2013, Chairman Dempsey was talking about two classes of citizens that had been created by the combat ban. Men and then women who had an asterisk, right? Because there were lots of jobs women still couldn't do, even if they were, for some intents and purposes, actually doing them already. And what you do see in elite units, at least what I have seen, and I will not say there's no problem, I would never say that, but what you've seen is a very high level of training and a high level of professionalism. And the women I speak to, there were women in Ashley's war who'd been sexually assaulted in their first deployment and wanted to do this mission because they wanted to put themselves in the toughest situation possible. And what they found were people who were really highly professional. They were shocked to see women there, right? But there were not lines crossed that they experienced.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Gail Samek-Lamon. She's the author of the book Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. And we're talking about the integration of women into combat positions, which is beginning this month. And let's talk about the training, because you said earlier that the women want to be held to the same standards as the men in training, and there's something called the Infantry Officer Course. You have to pass it to become a platoon commander. And 29 women have tried this, and none has passed.
And I think it's important to note that's the Marines, I think, that you're talking about uh-huh. there, right? And this was part of a pilot program. And so Army, Navy, about 15% female, Air Force a little more, and Marines about 7%. So it's also the branch that has the fewest women. And it was interesting because when I covered the opening of Army Ranger School, what you heard over and over again was, it's fine if only one person gets through or if zero people get through. And this was from women because they said that would prove to every doubter that we're not being held to a different standard. You know, we don't want a different standard. That is the thing that you hear over and over again. And the fact that three women have now graduated from Army Ranger School, which really went to great pains to be transparent to media right. about the standards.
And there have been some criticisms there that these women got special treatment, that they were allowed to repeat courses, that they got advanced training.
And I will say, this is where actually I will draw a line. I have not seen proof of any of those allegations, and I have looked into them and talked to people. And I've also talked to Rangers who did 13 deployments in the post-9/11 wars, whose friends run Rangers School. I mean, when you say that these women got special treatment, not you, but when people allege that, you're really impugning the integrity of everybody who runs Ranger School, a whole lot of whom don't even want women to be, at one point or another, did not want women to be Rangers, right? And there's been a lot of reporting and a lot of conversation around the fact that, you know, you see young men who went through Ranger School saying, when I couldn't hold a pack, you know, this person helped. And it was a great leveler. You know, we go down to cover Ranger School and it was like going to the zoo. Everybody's like, where's the female? Where's the female? And when we went back 3 months later to Swamp Phase, which is misery in northern Florida, right, in Camp Eglin in August, 104 degrees, important 4% humidity, the conversation was, where's the female? You know, every reporter is trying to figure out who the female is because everyone looked awful. Right.
I mean, you can tell.
No, you could not tell because it was just everybody's chewing gum to stay awake. Everybody looks underfed. Everybody looks exhausted. And, you know, That, to me, was a testament to the standard, right? That there was, there men repeat Ranger School courses all the time. And in fact, I think the person who's taken the longest what through Ranger course was a man. And then the leaders at Fort Benning went to a painful extent, right, to try to show reporters, here's the math, here's the numbers, here's everybody, and to show that they were not giving special treatment.
Are the Marines particularly opposed to women in combat? Because it seems that the leader of the Marines has made comments that he doesn't think that women should be there. There was a survey a few years ago that found 2/3 of the men in the Marines opposed allowing women in combat positions. Is there something separate about the Marines in this?
It is a very unique and distinct culture, and people are rightfully very proud of their service and their history. I think it's a harder culture to change, and there are fewer women. Uh-huh. So oftentimes you see it. It's interesting, though, because in some ways they've been slowest to adopt big changes, but at the forefront once those changes have been made. I mean, the fact that there's a woman, a female candidate going through Marine Special Operations assessment and selection this summer, and they put that out there, is, I think, a testament to that. In Ashley's war, we're talking about the female engagement teams, the Lioness teams in Iraq. This was long before, in the early 2000s, long before Ashley's war or any lifting of the combat ban was even thought of, really. And the Marines organized teams of women to go on patrols, to be doing this kind of patrolling missions alongside infantry. So I do think that the Marines have been at the forefront a lot of this. And you know, change is difficult for all cultures, and that's a particularly traditional one.
Okay, so what about selective service? What about the draft? Should women now be drafted?
It is such a fascinating question, and it came up in the interview I did with General McChrystal for mm-hmm. Ashley's War. This was in 2012, and that was really the first time I thought about this question. And look, the draft has been out since ended officially in 1973, was brought back in, selective service brought back in 1980 as a result of the Afghan-Soviet invasion. And so I think it is a relic of a different time, because if you see what senior military leaders are saying, which is that, you know, we want an all volunteer force. That's, I think, the first point. I think the second point is, let's have a national conversation. Let's have an honest discussion, because so much of the conversation around women in combat is what women could do or should do or are capable of. And almost none is about what they have already done, about the Silver Stars they have earned, about the Purple Hearts they have received, about the Bronze Star medals with the V device, which one of the young women in Ashley's War had received for leading her team through 36-hour firefight in Afghanistan, and about the fact that, you know, even in Ashley's War, there were two women who were in jobs that were coded for men, that meant officially only men could fill them. And their commanders were like, listen, we just want the best person. We'll go back and fix the HR stuff later, you know? And so I think it's really regulation catching up with reality, but let's have a national discussion about service.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today.
Pleasure to join you.
That's Gail Semek-Lamond. She's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. Are you a woman in the military? How have the new rules changed your job? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRWPRESSPLAY. Coming up, news stories for comic book hero Black Panther, written by MacArthur Genius winner Ta-Nehisi Coates, and a new video game takes you into the tumult of the 1979 Iranian Revolution.
Rez, over here!
Oh, you okay?
Yeah. Okay.
Where's Addy?
I lost them.
Take your pictures now before they tear gas the place. Show the world what's going on in our streets.
Comic books and video games next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
I am T'Challa,
the Prince of Wakanda. But what are you doing here?
I need your help.
T'Challa from the Kingdom of Wakanda is Black Panther, featured there with Captain America in the animated comic book series The Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes. Black Panther was the first Black superhero to appear in mainstream American comics back in 1966. 50 years later, Black Panther is having a good year. We'll see him on the big screen for the first time in Captain America: Civil War next month. And today, a new version of Black Panther's origin story hits comic shelves everywhere. It's written by rockstar public intellectual Ta-Nehisi Coates. Abraham Reisman is an editor at New York Magazine and Vulture.com. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, so good to be back. And I'm going to be a total stereotype of a comic book geek and correct you and say, it's not a retelling of his origin story. This is this new Black Panther series picks up where the story of Black Panther left off in previous stories in recent months.
Fantastic. So tell us where it picks up the story.
Well, it is about, as you said, T'Challa, which is the name of the monarch of Wakanda, a fictional, very technologically advanced African nation. And T'Challa's been through a rough patch recently. The world ended, and then it came back. This being comics, you know, nothing stays dead. Uh-huh. And his kingdom was invaded, and he was actually not king for a while after an assassination attempt and a falling out with his sister, who was the queen. And anyway, he's back on top, and now he's trying to figure out what it means to be a king and how to deal with some unrest from the populace.
Okay, let's go back in time now.
Yes.
To 1966, to the real origins of Black Panther. Who is he and how was he created?
So in 1966, one of the hottest comic books in the world, certainly in the United States, was this series called Fantastic Four. People may have heard of it. And it was a project that was co-done by these two amazing creators, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And in one of the issues, they introduced this character named T'Challa, who was the leader of Wakanda. And it was a completely iconoclastic depiction of a Black character for a comic book at the time, because this was a kingdom that had never been colonized. This was a place that had resisted all outsiders and had become fantastically advanced. I mean, far ahead of the United States. And the Fantastic Four basically get invited to Wakanda and end up in a little tiff, a little fight with T'Challa, but he reveals that he's just sort of training himself against these great warriors from the United States. And anyway, that was the introduction of the character, and he's been a mainstay for 50 years. Never the top seller for Marvel, but always something that fans are interested in.
Well, it's so interesting that he was created in the 60s, leading this nation in Africa, because that was at a time when a lot of African nations were seeking their independence from colonial powers.
Right. It's this period of massive decolonization. And, you know, Stan and Jack, the creators of the character, never really said that that was directly what was inspiring them, but they certainly were in the midst of this zeitgeist where it had to have been partially on their minds. And also, of course, you have the civil rights movement here in the United States. And both men have said that they wanted to create this character because they wanted to have a Black superhero. You know, Marvel was really booming at the time, but there weren't any Black leads, and they wanted to introduce someone who was one. And oddly enough, 1966 was also the year that the Black Panther Party formed and or introduced itself under that name. But that's a total coincidence. And the fact that it's a coincidence just goes to show how in the zeitgeist the comic was. You know, for whatever reason, this phrase was floating around in the ether, and both Stan and Jack and the political movement managed to come up with it.
Interesting. Okay, so let's head to the present now. How big a deal is it that Ta-Nehisi Coates is writing the series now?
It's massive. I mean, there's really no precedent for something like this. I mean, let's think for a second. Ta-Nehisi Coates is inarguably one of the most important nonfiction writers in the English language today. This guy wins award after award, shows up on all kinds of bestseller and best of the year lists for Between the World and Me, and he's also a comics geek, but hey, plenty of famous people are comics geeks. They don't also then end up writing a monthly comics series. But Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, Marvel announced in September that he would be writing this Black Panther series, and hopes were high. And I have to say, the first issue came out today, and the critical response and the fan response has been overwhelmingly positive. I'll break journalistic objectivity for half a moment and say I very much enjoyed it as well. Really, we've never seen this kind of thing happen, where you have one of the greatest thinkers at the top of his game in nonfiction writing taking on a fictional project for a major comic book company. It's really unlike anything I've ever seen.
And are there any political themes in there, any modernizations to struggle that's happening now?
Well, it's interesting. He said that he was inspired by a wide array of sources in the news, all kinds of stories that have been on his mind, you know, one being the rise of ISIS. And there is a certain amount of political discontent in Wakanda that's pushing people to acts of violence that they wouldn't necessarily have been pushed to if the country had been on surer footing. So I guess there's that, but I think people will be pleasantly surprised that it's in no way a polemic. You know, you may have read Between the World and Me and been impressed with how direct Ta-Nehisi Coates can be in expressing his political views, but his political views are not directly expressed in Black Panther. It's just a really good story. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. There may be something more transparently political in it, but right now it's just sort of a musing on the nature of government and the governed.
And how are the drawings?
Oh, Brian Stelfreeze is the artist who did the pencils, and they're gorgeous. Even if you have no interest in reading the story, I highly recommend shelling out $5 so you can graze your eyes over his wonderful landscapes in Wakanda and his terrific character design, good action stuff. It's just a cracking good piece.
Okay, and so then we're also going to see Black Panther on the big screen.
Yes, Chadwick Boseman will be taking up the mantle on the big screen for the first time. Very exciting. People are really amped up about that.
Right. And so when are we going to see that?
Captain America Civil War comes out in early May, and we don't really have any idea what Black Panther's specific role is going to be in it. He's on one of the sides in this titular civil war between the superheroes. You know, let me tell you, people who love superhero fiction and love the Marvel movies love to pull out every single second from every trailer and like turn them into gift sets on Tumblr. And people have been doing that with the scant little bit of footage that we've gotten of Black Panther in the trailers, and they've been doing it a lot. I mean, people are really hungry to see this character. Like I said, he's never been a top seller, but he's been this cult favorite for a long, long time. And, you know, I'm told, I've read about a lot of fans of color who have always thought of this character as an important piece of, you know, Afrofuturism and just great superhero storytelling that happens to star a Black man. And so, you know, that's something we haven't seen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe a whole lot. And, you know, I'm as in the dark as everybody when it comes to what actually happens in a Marvel movie before it comes out. But Chadwick Boseman, I mean, you must love him, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
of
he's
course.
Terrific, right?
He
Who
is.
Doesn't love Chadwick Boseman? That's going to be terrific. Yeah, he's very charismatic.
All right. Well, I can tell you're excited over the moon for this. So thank you for sharing your excitement with us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Abraham Riesman, editor at New York Magazine and Vulture.com. Coming up, a new video game takes you into the 1979 Iranian Revolution. What will you do? That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A video game out this week is set against the backdrop of the Iranian Revolution. Here's a little bit from the trailer for 1979 Revolution Black Friday.
You could go to hell. Do with me as you like.
Hell is what I'm trying to save you from, Reza General.
My name is Reza Shirazi, and this is my story.
Photojournalist Reza Shirazi is the game's protagonist. Through him, the player will have to overcome obstacle after obstacle in Tehran during the revolution and its aftermath, whether it's being interrogated by a torturer in Evin prison or deciding what to do after being shot. The game went on sale this week, and today I'm joined by the creator, Navid Kansari. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Madeline.
Okay, so when does this start? Right before the revolution?
It starts the summer of 1978 when people started kind of taking to the streets, believing in the possibility of change. And at that particular stage, it was all about hope and the belief of like nonviolent protest. And of course, as the revolution played out, it kind of took its own direction.
Why did you want to create a video game based on the revolution?
Well, I mean, I think that revolutions in general, in general, most times where we have moments where things are not set in stone and we're not sure about it, creates the greatest opportunity for us to make decisions. Whether they're right decisions or wrong decisions, in chaotic moments, we're forced to make them. And a revolution is a great place to put players, audience members, where they have to make choices, where their morality and their personal connection to family members and friends are being tested. So for us to try to make a game, an adventure game, set in the Iranian Revolution just gave us an incredible bed to create a narrative out of.
So as Reza, you're forced to make all sorts of decisions which will dictate what happens to you?
Absolutely. I mean, you'll make small decisions and you'll make big decisions. Some of the small decisions are, you know, how you interact with people and how people kind of interact with you. Are you being passive aggressive? Are you being aggressive? And then the bigger decisions are when the military does start shooting, who do you save when you have your brother on one side and your cousin on the other side? Mm-hmm. And so these are elements that push us to make these decisions and to navigate our own narrative. And as a result, we connect with the story because we're not just watching it. We're actually in it. We're in the shoes of somebody on the streets making these decisions. And typically, I think a lot of the ways that we're digesting history or how it's being provided to us is through the big events, the big kind of players and what they did, not the story of the masses and how they actually lived on a day-to-day basis within on the streets with their family and with their friends during a revolution.
So is there a way to win? Is there a right way to get through this game?
I don't know. I don't know if there's a right way to win a revolution. I think there's no personal glory in it. I think it's how you kind of go about it, doing what you think you need to do to survive. Members of the Islamic students would have a different approach as to how you win that 1979 revolution, as well as those who might be passive and would just want to kind of get on with their day-to-day lives, as well as those who supported the monarchy. So life has no winning and no losing. We have a lot of grayness, and I think games traditionally want to put people as black and white, and what we're trying to do is provide a shade of grayness that says everything that you do has an impact on others, and none of the choices that you make are so defined to say this person's a good person and this person's a bad person. We're just all shades of gray.
And Reza, the main character, is he based on an actual person?
Reza's story and the story of everybody in the game is an accumulation of 40 interviews that we did with a huge spectrum of people, regardless of their class, religious background, or social status. And so the highlights of those interviews wind up creating the narrative for Reza.
And how did you get the images?
The photography that we're using actually came from a photographer from France called Michel Sepon, who was in Iran from 78 until 79. And when we came across our initial research, his pictures, we reached out to him, and he was extremely generous and shared his entire Rolodex of photos that he had. And so the ones that resonated and we could kind of build gameplay around, like photography, and kind of show off Tehran during that time, is what we decided to utilize.
So you're from Iran yourself, right?
Yes.
Spent the first 10 years of your life there.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you incorporating your memories of Iran into this game?
Absolutely. This game has a lot of my personal memories as well as my personal experiences in it. My grandfather, who shot home movies on Super 8 from 1950 till 1979, those are all as a part of the exploration that you'll do when you're walking through the house. You'll be able to see those movies. You'll be able to see family pictures on the wall. You'll also wind up engaging with cultural elements of Iran, which has nothing to do with politics, such as the infamous act of Tarof, which is when you put everybody else's needs and good graces to such a huge high level that it can actually become quite irritating. but it's just about putting your good graces. So all of these things are a part of the culture and a part of my personal life that I also felt was important to show, distinguish, celebrate. And more importantly, in this particular political climate, it's great to actually bring a personality, something personal, so that we don't dismiss an entire group of people because of where we think they're from or from the news that's portrayed them in a certain light.
And will people in Iran be able to play this game?
This game is going to be is available worldwide right now to everyone to be able to play. And a lot of our support that's coming online is coming from within Iran and from the Iranian diaspora, but also from the West. There is a lot of people who are interested in seeing games go in this direction. They don't want to dispel what's existed. There's some big AAA games that are no different than big Hollywood movies, but the means and the medium of gaming can now expand into another direction and just grow as we add another genre called Verite games to it.
Well, I wonder if the Iranians and the Westerners play it differently or make different decisions based on where they're from.
I think it will be played differently, and I think that the analytics that we actually provide to people on the back end of the game to make you to let you see your choices and for you to be able to compare your choices really allows us to also take this game as an individual narrative experience and then compare it to how other people reacted in these specific moments of crisis. So I do hope so, because that starts the conversation. And obviously, one of the things that we want to come out of this game, aside from being entertained, is to start a conversation so we can kind of start dispelling the rhetoric that's presently taking place on either end of the spectrum politically.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Naveed Kansari, creator of the new video game. It's called 1979 Revolution Black Friday. And Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hi.
That's right. I might play video games now.
I know. That sounds like fun.
It sounds really fun. I wanted to know what our listeners find awesome about playing video games, whether it's a historical video game or something where you're just beating the crap out of each other. What's your favorite video game? Find us on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Tell us all about it. And if you've played this game, we want to hear from you as well, and maybe even send your favorite screenshots in. It's a very cinematic game.
Okay, great. That again, Twitter at KCRW Press Play or Facebook KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
And thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.